and welcome to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. This is a show that seeks answers to questions large and small, basically to satisfy my curiosity and hopefully yours as well, dear listener. Today, the question is a big one. We have a crisis or many crises of immigration at our southern border, and the United States is not really the good guy in this particular situation. And I have with me someone who has been very close to the immigration crisis on the southern border. She is Molly Matter, a human rights attorney, resident of Vashon Island, and principal at Amend Law LLC. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is a question that's been on our minds, everybody's minds in this country, for quite some time. But not everyone has been as active as you. How did you get interested in working with immigrants at the southern border?
Well, to be fair, I'm not an immigration attorney. So my background is actually in voting rights, and that's when I went to law school. But I have always studied and been fascinated by power, how we use power, how our government in the history of the United States has asserted its power. And that's what originally led me to law school. So when the zero tolerance policy came into effect, which was in April, but I think wasn't fully acknowledged until June, I wanted to do something. I think we all wanted to do something. And we felt powerless, and it triggered something very deep in all of us. Regardless of who we are, we all have, I think, experiences given our ancestry or our personal life, that this mothers and fathers and children being separated was just hit us at our core.
Yes.
You know, we have the chopping block in slavery. We have the Trail of Tears. We have boarding schools. Native American children being taken away from their families in boarding schools. We have children separated from families during the Holocaust. The list is long.
Yeah.
And we have today women that are incarcerated or people that are institutionalized and also taken away from their families. So to me, it was personal and political for sure. I think all things are.
Yes.
Right. And so I fortunately received an email from an organization that was asking for volunteers to go and take declarations of children within the detention centers. And what was wonderful about actually this outreach is it was a law professor from Whitman College. I think it was even on Facebook. You know, is anyone sort of interested? And 7,000 attorneys within a matter of days.
Oh my God.
Raised their hands.
Wow.
To volunteer. I will get on a plane. Tell me where to go.
That says a lot for how it touched people's core.
Yeah. And so this organization called the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law organized, and they have been on the forefront. They have been the leaders in setting the standard for children's human rights in detention or going through the immigration process here in the United States. So they organized the hundreds, if not thousands, of attorneys over the summer to take declarations of children and inspect the sites.
So what have you learned about how children's human rights are being handled or violated in these detention centers?
It's a long... We need more than 30 minutes for that. I think one of the biggest issues is that we don't know.
Why don't we know?
I mean, I can tell you specific things for sure, mm-hmm. but I think there is such a lack of transparency, and there is so much abuse that is being that is happening that we do not know, that we are unaware of. And I don't know if we want to go down this road yet, but for example, the the 7-year-old girl.
Yes, who died.
That was, yeah. You know, we did not find out about that for an entire week.
Oh, really?
Yes.
We being the public the attorneys working there?
No, we the public, American public. It took one full week for us to learn. The second child, the 8-year-old boy, we found out within 24 hours. So, and I think there was, there must have been some pressure after the first child died.
Some that, internal pressure in the what release. Governing body handles the detention centers?
Well, the Office of Refugee Resettlement and ICE. So yeah, as far as basic human rights that are being violated by children, there's a lot of law that governs basic human rights for all inhabitants of the United States. So even if you're, quote, illegal, which is a term that I'd love to unpack as well.
Yes.
You are given the exact same constitutional rights when you are inside the borders of this country. And this is precedent that has existed for 126 years. This is Supreme Court decisions. This is, you have your 14th Amendment rights. You have due process. You have equal protection of the laws. And so you have a right, you should have a right to an attorney. These children, some of whom, I won't give specific examples, of course, because I can't,
yes,
confidentiality, but I will say it's not uncommon for a child to be in detention center. I'm going to call them prisons because that's what they are.
Yes.
For 5 months without even knowing what the word asylum means, without even seeing an attorney. Under federal law, what the law that the Center for Constitutional Law and, the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law, this wonderful organization that's mm-hmm. been fighting for children's rights for the last 30 years, what they did is in 1987, we had the Flores Agreement. I'm sure people have heard about this. The Flores Agreement is what we have today as the most protective rights for children.
Mm-hmm.
So going through asylum, coming into the country as refugees or immigrants. And what it states is that children should not be in prison longer than 5 days, at most 20. So they should be released within 5 days. A child should not be institutionalized or in prison for longer than 5 days, and they should have the right to be released to these four different parties.
So how is ICE getting around that?
How is the administration doing anything it's doing?
Well, good point.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, so after the zero tolerance policy went into effect, the Trump administration requested that the Judge McGee, who was the judge that decided the Flores settlement, requested that she put aside the Flores agreement.
Oh.
And thank goddess, she said no.
Good.
This is law. These are human rights. Mm-hmm. And we, something I think important too, is that we have never signed on to the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child. We are the only country out of 196 countries that has ratified, which has made it our law, which is a basic standard of human rights for children. And one of those rights is that that children will not be separated from their families, and that if they come to the border as refugees, we will reunite them. We will work to reunite them and assist them and give them services and give them make sure that their culture is taken into consideration, language. So for instance, in the detention centers, there's all English. Everything's in English. These children are Spanish speakers or they're indigenous speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we have severely violated the International Treaty on the Rights of Children.
So let me just clarify. Mm-hmm. And the United States is the only country in the developed world or in the world in general?
the only country out of all the countries that have signed on in the United Nations League, you know, 100 and right. I think we have 196 countries.
So the U.S. is the only country that has not signed on to this international human rights agreement, another notch in the year of disillusionment
and this has
for
been
our country.
Since 1989, we have had the opportunity, you know, we had the opportunity to sign on under Obama. Obama administration was the first administration to actually review it fully, and it has been, which is good, it's a step in the right direction. And the reason we haven't signed on has been Republican senators and conservative sort of far-right think tanks that are in fear that this standard will usurp their sovereignty and parental sovereignty, such as, you know, part of the international treaty says children have freedom of thought. So some parents and people of power running conservative think tanks want to make sure that, well, does that mean religion? Because maybe I want to make sure that my child is raised in my religion, you know, and does not have that freedom to explore a different religion, which is interesting because culturally, that's an okay thing. We see Muslim countries have signed on, actually, and actually have made that exception. We are going to still have, you know, this Muslim faith a part of our education and our government. So they have made their own, I don't want to say exceptions to the rule, but they have said, we believe enough in the human rights of children, and yet we are still going to work within the confines of our own cultural.
So they've managed to sign on to the International Human Rights Agreement and make it work within their country, whereas the U.S. is refusing to do that. So let's go on to the impact that that has on children currently in these detention centers. And can you tell us, you've been working primarily at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, correct?
I went first to Arizona and worked with children. And I came back realizing I needed to work within my own community. I also have a 5-year-old at home, and I can't, and, you know, fly around the country. So I got a call from Maru Vilipanova. I'm not sure. I apologize if I've said her last name incorrectly. She runs Northwest Detention Center Resistance. She's been very vocal for many, many years, definitely over a decade, in the humane treatment of detainees. And so she asked attorneys to go in and take declarations of detainees that were on hunger strike. So I thought I would go in and just gather those declarations and give it back to her. And then I quickly became involved in one man's journey and ended up representing him.
And this was, can you tell us his name?
Yeah, his name is Vadim Machulin. And he is Armenian. He was a persecuted ethnic minority from Russia.
And you have a comment from him.
Yes.
That will illustrate for us some of the experience that these people are having. And was he in the Northwest Detention Center? He was in Arizona.
He and his mother crossed the border, the Mexican border. And yes, he was transferred up to the Northwest Detention Center.
Okay, so let's play a comment from, say his name again, Molly.
Vadim Machulin.
I'm not criminal. I didn't violate any visa terms. I suppose the system is working to, how can I explain, to make people more calm. To more quiet. They need to wait in uncertainty. Maybe someone, they will be released, maybe tomorrow, maybe after half of a year. They try to squeeze the people's will.
Yeah, they try to take away people's will.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a system working for this, to separate relatives, to keep them in jail, to don't provide any information.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what reason for don't provide any information about my case, only to take off the will of the people.
Yeah.
You are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. And we can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate, who supports all our information programming and our emergency alert service. I'm talking with human rights attorney Molly Matter, and you just heard a comment from a gentleman that Molly eventually represented in his deportation case. Can you tell us Vadim's story now?
Mm-hmm. Vadim came with his mother, young man, seeking asylum as a persecuted ethnic minority Armenian in Russia. And he and his mother crossed the Mexican border and presented themselves legally and had their current passports, which did not expire until 2028.
Mm-hmm.
They just got their passports. You know, they sold everything they owned. They left everything they knew to start a life. And they were separated at the border. His mother was sent to San Diego, and he was transferred up here to the Northwest Detention Center.
So they were separated.
Mm-hmm. He was not allowed to speak to his mother for 5 months. His mother only speaks Russian. He has limited English, but it was enough. And he made it through the first stage of asylum proceeding, which is that you have to prove you have a credible fear that you have been persecuted. And then he was told in June, so they came in, I believe, the end of March. He was told in June he would have a decision from a judge within a few days about his release. So he would be released from prison, and they would go through these asylum proceedings. He learned nothing for 5 weeks and sat there for 5 weeks.
Wow.
With no contact to his mom, nothing from ICE. So he asked to be deported.
What was it that made him want to be deported more than to try and stay here and be presumably safe in asylum?
Well, I think that speaks volumes about how inhumane the conditions are inside the detention centers, the prisons. You know, they're not administrative centers. These are prisons.
Uh-huh.
And these are places of punitive, you know, they have been built to be punitive. And I think he realized how unbearable it was to be in this no man's land, to not be able to know what was happening, that it was worth going back to prison in Russia. It was worth being persecuted. The risk was no longer, it wasn't worth the risk. It wasn't worth the risk anymore to see if he could get asylum here.
Mm-hmm. So, Molly, Vadim chose to be deported back to a place where his life was in danger, rather than stay in the detention center. Did he ever find out what was happening with his mother?
So his mother, yes. He began, how I met him is he was on hunger strike, or he had done a hunger strike. Mm-hmm. And then I visited him while he was on hunger strike again. And his only demands were to be released and to have his mother transported up here to the Northwest Detention Center.
Oh.
And so because he couldn't speak with her. And this is one of the issues that we're seeing also in the detention centers with children, that there's no communication. They are not allowed to speak to their parents. Right now, the ORR states that each child can speak to their parents twice a week for 10 minutes. That is it.
That's all?
That is all.
Why? What is supposed to be accomplished with this separation of families? How do they possibly justify this?
There is no justification. There is, you know, the I mean, obviously, the Trump administration justified the separation of families as a tactic to deter immigrants from coming into the country, right? So we will punish children. We will abuse children. And the American Pediatric Academy stated loud and clear, this is child abuse. So there is, yeah, there. That's a different conversation, but I think, to get back to Vadim.
Yes, okay.
That he, so he, one of his hunger strikes was successful, and...
Meaning?
I know. Meaning that it got the outcome that he, you know, that he requested, which is, I said, if you stop your hunger strike, we will transport your mother up here. You will be able to see her.
And they did that?
And so they did that. And so he stopped hunger strike, and he was able to see his mother, I believe once or maybe twice, but while he was at Northwest Detention Center. So the what happened, this is I think the most mind-blowing thing about his story, is that he asked to be deported, but yet he couldn't get deported because ICE actually lost his passport.
Oh my God.
ICE lost his passport and his mother's passport. And I even spoke with his ICE officer, who stated to me, yes, that is what happened. This wasn't something they hid. It was misplaced. They were lost. So now he's in this no man's land of wanting to leave, wanting to just, you know, accept the failure of trying to seek asylum and return, and yet being stuck because Russia cannot take him because he doesn't have valid travel documents.
So am I to understand he's basically trapped in the Northwest Detention Center with no recourse?
Well, that's what the law was until, I think, somewhat recently, within the last 10 years, there was a Supreme Court decision. There was a man that was in exactly his same decision. I mean, in his same position for 9 years. 9 years in this country.
In a jail?
Yes. And that's what prompted, finally, a Supreme Court decision to say, okay, while you're in this limbo, no man's land, mm-hmm. you should at least be released. You do not, you know.
Yeah.
There was no flight risk. There was no criminal activity. There was no reason for him not to be outside the prison and waiting for his travel documents. And there's a wonderful organization in Tacoma that gives temporary housing and social services to detainees, you know, for a few months mm-hmm. during their asylum proceedings or during this limbo stage. So there's yes. a place for him to go, as well as sponsors.
Was he able to take his mother with him? Was she released as well?
Yeah. So what eventually happened was I actually reached out to the Vashon community and asked if we could get letters of support from different organizations mm-hmm. that are conscious of what's going on in with this crisis, and received some letters of support asking for his release. We were not successful. The ICE continued to... To back up, when a judge makes a determination, whether it's now we're going down, you know, more asylum proceedings or we're going into deportation, every 3 months, ICE has to review this case and determine whether it's appropriate to continue to house and imprison the detainee. So when the 3-month mark came, ICE could have said, please, you're released, you know, we'll wait or not. And then at the 6-month mark, detainees actually have a right to apply for habeas corpus, which has been successful since this Supreme Court decision happened. It's been successful getting people released that are in this limbo stage, in this place of no man's land.
So each of these limbo cases is mm-hmm. reviewed by ICE every 3 months. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what if they're released? So if for instance, they are released and they are being housed by some charitable organization, mm-hmm. is ICE still reviewing their case every 3 months?
No, that's just in order for them to be released or not.
Okay, so yeah. while they're in the detention center.
Right, I mean, they are still under, I would say, sort of supervision of ICE. You know, they can't travel. You know, they're undergoing either deportation or asylum. Mm-hmm. But again, it's odd. I'm not an immigration attorney. I've only learned this over the last 6 months.
Sounds like you've been learning a lot.
I want to understand as much as I can, you know, as well as the context of why we are where we are, and the history of why we are who we are.
Is there a way you can summarize what you've learned about that? Can you tell us? You said why we are who we are.
So when we look at the border, the mm-hmm. southern border.
Yes.
For over 100 years, we had something called circular migration. It was Mexican laborers were pillars of our economic structure.
Yes.
It was, this is what it is. So we had circular migration, people coming in to the harvest, running agriculture. There was not the term immigrant. There was not the term illegal. And yet it didn't disrupt white America, because at that time, Mexican laborers were racially ineligible for citizenship, just as Chinese and Asian, we had laws that people were racially ineligible
yes.
for citizenship.
Right.
So when, and to back up a little bit more, we have, in 1848, we have the American invasion of Mexico, where 80,000 Mexicans become, quote, citizens of the United States.
So they can
fight.
No.
This is the expansion of the slave plantation. So this is also what Abraham Lincoln, Henry David Thoreau, and Frederick Douglass opposed the expansion of the United States and the expansion of slavery. And Henry David Thoreau actually went to prison for this, and this is where he wrote Civil Disobedience, which is an excellent book, excellent essay to read these days.
This sounds almost like another show. We're down to 2 minutes left.
So the history is we have, half of Mexico's territory is taken by the United States. Then we have an agricultural system that necessitates laborers, and we exploit or use Mexican laborers to freely come and go and do the harvest. 1965, then we have something called the Bracero Program. So finally it's regulated. So it's completely unregulated. People come and go,
mm-hmm.
right? So then we have a Bracero Program, which was in 1942, that finally states, well, we're having temporary contracts now. So, and that should require adequate housing and adequate food and, you know, for people coming
for the workers.
Workers, right. And then we have, has its own story, but then we have 1965, all of a sudden we have what used to be circular migration is now, quote, immigration, and actually has a quota. We have, just as every other country, just as Southern Europeans or Eastern Europeans. So now, and then we, on top of that, have the term illegal, which is a convenient way to create a status of a people so that we have a legal way to discriminate.
Fascinating. And we have 1 minute left.
I just want to say the history of discrimination and the negative attitudes towards Central Americans and Latin Americans is our history of white nationalism and white supremacy in this country. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is also the media of Miami Vice, of decades of drug cartels and drug lords, and not seeing Latinx people as mothers and scientists and teachers and humans, you know.
And that's how we got to where we are.
And it's, I know we only have a few seconds left, but it's also what has made Trump. I think we need to understand that these are the causes and conditions that have created a person and a system that we have to now individually and collectively dissent from.
And try to correct. Yes. Molly Matter, I can't thank you enough for joining us here on Real Talk. Molly will be telling the stories that she can't tell on the air, January 20th at the Land Trust Building, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, with a meeting of the Showing Up for Racial Justice chapter on Vashon. So, Molly, I hope we can hear more from you later and after your presentation at Surge. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here at the Jean Bosch Radio.
The Jean Bosch yes. Broadcast Studio,
yes.
Right here on Vashon Highway. Thank you for listening to Real Talk, folks. We're here every Tuesday at noon and Friday at 6. And thanks to the composer of our theme music, he's Luke McQuillan. Stay tuned. You never know what you're going to get on KBSH.